You have to think about efficiency across different dimensions, right? Because Uniswap comes from this world where you get 15 million gas every 12 seconds for the entire blockchain. And so things like having the curve be very computationally is important. But if your compute is increased by a factor of like 100 or 1,000 or maybe even more, maybe there's more financially efficient things you can do that are computationally more expensive.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors. MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH. Exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV, an intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%. GM, everyone. My name's Degachi, the host of Scraping Bits. And today, I'm with Eugene Chen from Ellipsis Labs. How's it going?
GM.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. Appreciate the time in this very busy hour. Just for the people that aren't familiar with you, who are you and what do you do?
I'm Eugene. I'm one of the co-founders here at Ellipsis Labs. The company's been around for just under 2 years now. Our first product is Phoenix, which is a fully on-chain limit order book DEX on Solana. Prior to working at Ellipsis Labs, I spent a couple of years sort of just being online, doing a bunch of different stuff in crypto, and prior to that, about 4.5 years in product engineering.
Product engineering. Nice. That should translate pretty well for Ellipsis. Interesting. And you've also done some HFT in the past, haven't you?
That's right. I did, as part of my into crypto, spent a little bit of time doing centralized exchange, HFT on crypto exchanges in particular.
Nice. Was that SexDex or just centralized?
Just centralized.
Okay, interesting. So you know a lot about the exchanges, which really helps the Phoenix. Just before we go into that, though, what was your past in a more extensive kind of overview before getting into crypto? And how did you see yourself getting into crypto and getting to the point where you are now?
Yeah, so my original background is really in math. I was a math contest kid way back in the day, middle school, high school. I've run into a lot of those same folks in the crypto world.
Oh, really?
I went to college. I had a pretty standard math kid experience there where the primary options post-school were software engineering, quant trading, and academia. So I did a little bit of exploring during my undergrad years in all those directions and ended up going down the Silicon Valley product engineering route. Okay. So yeah, spent about 4.5 years working at startups of various sizes, doing various product engineering related things. I really got into crypto, honestly, similar to how many people did in 2020, 2021, basically spending a lot of time indoors, bored on the internet, found crypto that way. And really the thing that got me onboarded was trying to bet on the election in 2020. And FTX was the best place to do it. And so sent some money over to FTX, bet on the election, ended up with a little bit of a role to play with there. And just started looking at some of these coins, took me down the DeFi rabbit hole, and that was that.
Interesting. Did you ever get into like the MEV game as well?
No, I never played MEV myself. Nope.
Damn. Hey, you still got time. Still got time on Solana.
I hear it's more competitive than it was in 2020.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting games on Solana relative to Ethereum because of the whole mutexes situation. But I also think like a lot of technical debt you can abuse as well, which is kind of, you know, I think cybersecurity experts are super good on Solana because they just find some kind of like tech debt, you know, incorporate that into their own strategies, and then whoever has the most kind of wins. But anyway, how did you find yourself going from Ethereum to Solana? And then what was the major point in your crypto career that made you go, wait, I need to build this product, Phoenix, and we should do it on Solana?
Yeah, so I had a little bit of experience in quant trading coming into starting to look at crypto, starting to look at what was happening in DeFi. This was during the time when all the coins were going up. It seemed like from the outside, at least, like all the protocols just worked. We implement some exchange that takes like 100 lines of code and wow, everyone just makes money forever. And this sort of breaks a lot of axioms from traditional finance. And so I spent a lot of time, and you know, to their credit, I think Ethereum has this really great open source culture, which extends beyond the code, but also to things like protocol design, where a lot of the discussions of, hey, do these protocols work? What are like the fundamental things that are happening here? Those discussions happen out in public. Mm-hmm. And so it was pretty easy to get in there and, you know, start participating. And so the way this ended up happening for me was I spent a lot of time like arguing on the internet with people about AMMs and are AMMs really financial alchemy? Does XY equals K actually outperform everything that exists in the traditional financial world? Where my answer was no. And as everything was going up, a lot of people had the answer of yes. And so I spent just like a lot of time complaining on the internet. Why is no one building things that I think would be like the more important DeFi primitives to build if DeFi is to be truly competitive with centralized exchanges and traditional finance? And at some point, you know, like I realized, okay, no one else is going to do it. Kind of just have to do it ourselves.
Right. And what was this grand idea you had, and why was it better or is better than traditional AMMs like, you know, Uniswap, V2, V3?
Well, first of all, I'd say it's not a grand idea. Limit order book is not an invention from Ellipsis Labs. Limit order books have been around in traditional finance in basically since the advent of electronic trading. So that's, you know, multiple decades. And Phoenix is also not even the first limit order book on Solana, not the first on-chain limit order book. Serum was one of the first programs ever deployed to Solana. I believe it came out in March or April of 2020. Right around when Solana launched mainnet beta. And yeah, they're just like, you know, building Solana programs in 2020 is very different from building Solana programs in, well, at the time, 2022. There's just like so much more known about what are the best practices, what are some of the trade-offs involved. And that project had been not quite abandoned, but effectively abandoned. And we thought we could do a better job. And so Phoenix was really intended to be, and I would say still is, a proof of concept, that even in the very adverse, very competitive on-chain environment, it's still possible for active liquidity to outperform passive liquidity. Hmm. And outperformance sort of comes in two dimensions that I care about, at least. One of them is profitability of the market makers, profitability of the liquidity providers. And then the other is in the quality of the liquidity. So can you have market makers on chain that are active, that are making money while also providing better prices to the end users? And so, yeah, we built Phoenix, launched in, I guess, more of a soft launch, where we launched with no UI in February of 23, launched the UI in August of 2023, and it's sort of been off to the races from there.
And what was it like going from nothing to a product? I know you have that product engineering background. So what did you apply from that previous experience to now? Was this your first startup, or you've done a few in the past?
The first startup of my own. I think there's a lot of Silicon Valley lessons that apply to crypto and plenty that do not. So the most important thing that you learn in Silicon Valley, this is some like old YC sayings, old YC lessons, basically like, you know, you really want to know as quickly as possible if your product thesis makes sense. So you want to take some really shitty version of your product that you can build as quickly as possible, take it to the market and see if the market wants it or not.
Right.
And I think this also applies in crypto on the product side, but there are areas in which like you cannot just run as quickly as possible because there's real money at stake. Users are putting real dollars into your smart contract code. And if there is some sort of vulnerability, then your users are going to lose money. So there's like a duty to the users, a duty to the capital that people are putting into these protocols, where you can't really move fast and break things. There's still other areas where, yeah, you know, you really want to decrease the amount of time, minimize the amount of time it takes to get something to the market so you can validate your product thesis. So for us, it was like not obvious that on chain, you can both provide price improvement and have profitable liquidity providers, because there are these gas costs that are associated with placing and canceling orders on a fully on-chain order book.
Oh yeah,
which you know, decreases market maker profitability. And then you're competing against these AMM LPs that are really, really insensitive to whether or not they make money. So like, you can definitely get one or the other. You can definitely have profitable market makers, or you can provide better prices. It's not clear you can get both. And so with Phoenix, you're like, okay, we need to get this out as quickly as possible, onboard some market makers, and see, at least in the current environment, is it possible to, for market makers, Phoenix, to be profitable while still being able to win some of the flow from aggregators.
With a fully on-chain order book, the immediate question that I have is, how do you bring people from other exchanges providing liquidity to come on your exchange to provide liquidity?
Do you mean other DEXs or?
Yeah.
So, well, it's easier to start from the centralized exchange side. So let's start there, where those are the same types of market makers that would be potentially interested in market making on Phoenix. Mm-hmm. In theory, you can sort of just like plug in your system that knows how to trade on a limit order book. Now, there's a lot of nuances in how do you trade on Solana, but you know, they will have a lot of infrastructure already set up for quoting on order books, for analyzing the strategies, adapting the strategies, seeing if they're profitable, seeing how to be maximally profitable. From the decentralized exchange side, this is, I think, like a pretty big miss for us with the Phoenix product, where there's no way for, you know, some guy who is providing liquidity in Radium, which you do with one click, right? You just like deposit asset A, deposit asset B, and then something happens. You're just done. And to be a systematic liquidity provider on Phoenix, you need to write code, you need to understand how you're going to land your transactions, you need to develop a strategy. So these are things that are not really accessible to most of retail traders, right, who are the primary source of AMM liquidity.
Right. So how do you simplify this process for them? Well, I guess this is a key challenge that you're facing. So what are your current approaches to fixing this, and maybe any future fixes that are down the road that you need to get the stepping stone to get towards?
Yeah, so I wouldn't view this necessarily as a thing that needs to get fixed. It's more just an observation that the like the profile of liquidity provider is very different on a limit order book versus on an AMM.
Right.
And the AMM implicitly is making this like value choice or like value judgment that anyone should be able to provide liquidity. Anyone should be able to provide liquidity in the same way. And then with the limit order book, you really, really expand the space of strategies that liquidity providers can employ, and also increase the barrier to entry. And the trade-off there is then hopefully you get higher quality liquidity, but Joe Schmo on MetaMask is probably not going to do super well setting up their very first market making bot.
Right. Yeah. I guess having maybe like even an open source one that just does like basic market making would be quite useful. Have you thought about doing that? Or maybe you do have it already?
Yeah, we do have this already. We haven't publicized it aggressively. I don't think it's really
ready.
Well, it's ready. Like anyone, and it's open source, and it's online on GitHub right now. Anyone can go take it and run it. But going from a thing that can, you know, place some orders on chain is very different from implementing a profitable strategy. And that's not something that we're too keen on advertising aggressively towards retail traders. We definitely don't want to come out and say, hey, like run this thing and you're guaranteed to make money, because guess what? You're not guaranteed to make money. You need to, you know, always be iterating on your strategies, and competition is quite fierce on chain.
Right.
And yeah, the professionals are probably going to have a better shot at it than retail. But the building blocks are there, the SDKs are there. I think it is relatively easy to get started trading on Phoenix in a systematic way. I just don't think most people should be doing it.
Okay. Just because it's too complex, unless you really know how to do it, right?
Most of them are going to lose money.
Okay. Nice. So why did you decide to go the decentralization route of putting it all on chain instead of doing, you know, off chain and then executing on chain as you being the sole, I guess, settler?
I think that's a very valid approach. We are seeing a couple of teams working on stuff like that today. I guess Cube and Backpack are the main examples on Solana. I believe there's some working on this on the Ethereum side as well. It's just a different point in the trade-off space. I think from an aesthetic point of view, one really nice thing about DeFi is everything is completely transparent, right? So you know the matching engine is going to be honest. You can audit the matching engine for yourself. The network sort of takes care of transaction inclusion and ordering. Now, that's a whole nother rabbit hole we can get into. Definitely affects, you know, market makers and all the other traders on Phoenix and the rest of the chain. But the transparency and auditability is the most important piece in my mind, where you have all these guarantees around honesty, and then you also know, or you can like take the, you can find the Phoenix code, the program code, the matching engine code. You can find it on GitHub. You can compile it down on your own machine and verify that this binary matches the binary that lives on chain. And so if you believe in the integrity of the blockchain, then you know, okay, like I'm not getting, there's like some set of ways in which like a centralized exchange can screw you, where this type of decentralized exchange just like cannot.
I mean, that's a good point. If, since it's all on chain, I think something inherent in all centralized platforms is they can say that it's all fair, but maybe they have a secret backdoor handshake that they're partnering with someone else, but they get it maybe slightly faster than everyone else, like the public, or I don't know, like they just have some slight advantage over someone else, or everyone else.
Yeah. And this, I mean, this exists on many crypto centralized exchanges, right? Where if you're like a large market maker, you get priority data, which turns out to be very, very useful for high frequency trading in particular. Now, it's not to say that you can't develop a similar type of advantage on Solana. It's just not going to come from Phoenix directly. So like, yeah, you can probably get access to data a little bit faster if you own like 10% of the Solana stake, but that's in our eyes, out of our hands.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. 100%. The concept of it is way better than something centralized. That's the whole point of crypto, is to decentralize it all. So if, yeah, it's kind of against the premise of it. If you have some centralized platform on a decentralized platform, is it really decentralized at that point? Maybe partially.
Yeah, I view decentralization more as a means to an end, at least for the purpose of finance. And I mean, I think there's a lot of good arguments for, you know, why blockchains need to be maximally decentralized for a particular set of use cases. You know, Bitcoin, I think, makes a lot of sense here, where to be something like global digital gold, you need to be like super, super neutral and whatnot. For something like financial applications, I think, again, there's a spectrum of, you know, you're trading off efficiency and decentralization in a bunch of places, because efficiency comes with performance.
Right.
And yeah, there's like some models that are going to work only if you relax some constraints around decentralization. And so then when we think about it, we think about what are the properties we want to get from decentralized infrastructure? Because there's like decentralization for the sake of decentralization, which I think is like this, you know, it's a very cool nerd snipe. There's a lot of very interesting engineering problems and research problems that show up there. But for us, what we really care about is, hey, you don't need to trust the developer of the exchange. You can verify all the code. You know, the matching engine is not going to lie to you. So really transparency and verifiability. Yeah. And maybe we don't need some of these other properties that decentralization gives you.
Definitely. How can you go beyond just traditional order books and AMMs though? Like what would be the next step to the next generation of DEXs in your mind? Or what would you like to see actually?
Yeah, so there's a couple things I'd like to see. So first, there's a lot of improvements that need to be made on the infra side, where the performance of the blockchains is very constraining. The way I like to put this is, when you expand the amount of compute or decrease the cost of compute on chain or compute or other resources, you really increase the protocol design space. So if your blockchain, if you have a new blockchain that has significantly lower fees, significantly higher throughput, significantly lower jitter, maybe there's some much more efficient, much better protocols you can build on top of that that weren't previously buildable. And so I think with Solana, this is clearly the order book, the fully on-chain order book. that, you know, it did exist on Ethereum, right? We had Ether Delta way back in the day, and the liquidity is just, you know, really, really poor, partially because the costs are so high. So it's not really viable to run any sort of active market making strategies. So you sort of get this, you get the step function improvement in protocol design from the improvements in infrastructure. And so I think the more we continue to push the infra layer, the more that can be done on the application layer as well. On the application layer, this is where I'm really the most interested. And we've been thinking a lot about this as we work towards future iterations of Phoenix, future iterations of on-chain exchanges. And again, like Phoenix, we call it Phoenix V1 internally now. Phoenix V1 really is a proof of concept. It's just trying to prove out that active liquidity can outperform passive liquidity. Now we're thinking about how do we make active liquidity as good as possible? How can we go beyond the limit order book? What can we do on chain that maybe has not been tried on centralized exchanges, really wading into these waters that haven't really been explored? And most of the ideas just like are not going to work out, and hopefully a couple of them do. So we're, you know, always talking to market makers about, hey, like, what would you need to provide better liquidity? Get as creative as possible. There's a bunch of stuff we can do in the matching engine itself. The basic stuff is like implementing different order types. You can do things that are like more like Uniswap style hooks, where you attach a piece of code to an order. You can have like programmable liquidity curves to support passive liquidity. There's a lot that can still be done in this design space of on-chain exchanges that just like has not really been explored. Right. And so, I think that's some of the most exciting stuff that we're working on right now.
Have you ever thought about doing like hybrid liquidity? So you have the active liquidity of order books, but also, I guess, kind of passive as well, like the Uniswap versions, like V2, V3. Have you ever thought about that?
Yep. I think it makes a ton of sense to put them together. You give retail an opportunity to provide liquidity. Also, like one big problem with AMM today, the opportunity for sandwiching. And if you end up with a bunch of limit orders in the same environment as the two-sided liquidity, the opportunity for sandwiching goes down pretty dramatically. So I think it makes a ton of sense for them to live together. You know, if retail really wants to provide liquidity, they can, or they should be able to. And maybe we can do better than XY equals K. Maybe we can do better than Uni V3 style concentrated liquidity. I think like programmable liquidity curves make a ton of sense here, where you know, you can just parameterize how you want to provide your liquidity based on you know, the properties of the assets that you are providing liquidity on. Tons of interesting stuff to do here.
I think programmable liquidity is very interesting because the V2 one is just hyper inefficient. V3 is great, but then you kind of have to build, I mean, you have to program it to really make it efficient if it's highly volatile and it's going outside the...
You have to think about efficiency across different dimensions, right? Because Uniswap comes from this world where you get 15 million gas every 12 seconds for the entire blockchain. And so things like having the curve be very computationally is important. But if your compute is increased by a factor of like 100 or 1,000 or maybe even more, maybe there's more financially efficient things you can do that are computationally more expensive.
Yeah. What about also optimizing, I guess, the bytecode of the contracts? I know like gas or compute units on a Solana isn't as expensive as, but you know, it still adds up. And if you decrease the amount of like hyper optimize the contracts just on Ethereum, like all the huffers, all the optimizers. I mean, if you do that on Solana as well, now you have more space for adding more shit, more transactions, more logic, just because that's at the end of the day, a compiler problem as well though.
Yep. So there's a bunch of this has never been a problem on Solana up until the last few months, because Solana was just never constrained by the supply of block space. So a lot of programs that exist on Solana today are just like not really compute optimized. There's just no need, because the cost to place transaction is so low and depends very little on how much compute is used. Yeah. This is changing because one, users are becoming more cost sensitive, or at least a particular type of user, like a market maker, is very cost sensitive. They care if the, you know, it costs 1 cent to place a transaction versus half a cent. And so they will be doing some gas optimizations here. And then also the fee mechanisms in Solana are finally starting to kick in because, you know, if you think about it, like a base and prio fee, you used to basically get in with no prio fee all the time. And then now fee, which depends on how much gas your transaction is going to use. So there's incentive now for both the application developer and the guys who are programmatically sending transactions to the chain to optimize their compute usage. I don't know if today people are getting all the way down to, you know, bytecode level optimizations. I think there's a lot of 80-20 sort of low-hanging fruit out there. We definitely tried to design Phoenix in a way where it was like not too compute intensive, but we did not optimize it all the way. And I think that was the correct decision for us.
Yeah, I think it's very small niche. So I think that's kind of end game, but I think definitely down the road it's going to happen. It's just, yeah, if you want to make something super efficient. But then again, it's allocating resources and time.
Yeah, and it's like, who is incentivized to do it, right? Because so like the searchers on Ethereum in the like MEV Geth days, you're actually really incentivized to get your gas consumption down to the literal minimum because you're bidding in terms of opportunity size divided by gas used, right? On Solana, the auction is, first of all, it's not really an auction, but the priority mechanism is far less efficient. And so if you use like 10% less gas than me, it doesn't mean you win 100% of the trades. You might win like 55% and you will have like ever so slightly higher margins. So the bounty available for being the best gas optimizer is significantly lower.
Yeah, I think on Solana, it's more of a position timing matter rather than how optimized are you? Because it's really about the scheduler. At the end of the day.
Yeah, there's a bunch of ways to optimize your transaction inclusion on Solana. One of them is gas, although I think gas is just like not super important. And making sure the leader hears your transaction, making sure you make it into the scheduler, turn out to be like harder problems than they sound like.
Yeah, and also like the spamming games as well. I can lock your account, which you use to execute, just because the mutex and your transactions get sent back to the queue. It's a whole lot more fun involved, but also a lot harder. Have you seen any kind of like toxic flow happening around Phoenix? Any kind of MEV games? Because I imagine if you have fully on-chain an order book, then you could kind of like bundle that up with other transactions. If they're just sitting there, like basically people have their funds. Oh yeah, I want to buy this token. It's just kind of sitting there and no one's executing. But then you could like readjust another pool, and then that's a kind of cross pool right there. I mean, maybe you've seen some of this. I don't know. It's just kind of thinking on the fly right now.
Yeah, there's a bunch of different types of flow on Phoenix. There's like atomic ARB flow, which tends to be non-toxic to Phoenix and toxic to the AMM, because usually the way this manifests is the world fare has changed, like, or the Binance price has changed. Market maker updates their quotes now. Now there's an arbitrage between Phoenix and some AMM that hasn't moved its quotes, and that ARB is likely to be non-toxic to Phoenix and toxic to the AMMs. There is also SexDex flow, which is primarily toxic to Phoenix. And then, of course, there's the normal retail flow, which primarily comes from aggregators to Phoenix.
Right.
And that is usually biases non-toxic.
Is there any way you can minimize this toxic flow? Like, for example, the SexDex?
I think it's tough. I think it's a latency game for sure. And then there's also these like bidding problems where it depends on how these auctions end up getting designed and how efficient they end up being. But let's say there's like three market makers and they're all about to get, or they all want to cancel because their orders are all about to get picked off. They're going to send like three separate transactions to cancel their three orders. Whereas the toxic guy coming in only needs to send one transaction with one tip, and probably out tip each of those three individually. So there are some dynamics here that I think are quite unfavorable to market makers in the long run if no changes are made.
What kind of changes do you think should be made. I wonder, what do you think would happen if you like prioritize cancels over non-cancels?
You're going to lose some atomicity guarantees here, because then you need basically something to, like, so you, if you can't do this in the matching engine itself without having multiple transactions required to place the order, right? Because then it's like place order, like place the IOC order, then that goes into some sort of like queue of things waiting to get executed. Then you have like one block for, you know, cancels, and then someone like pulls a crank to say, okay, now all these IOC orders can go through. And so you lose, it's like atomicity of the exchange itself. And I think that's probably just, I mean, it would help with this specific problem of DEX-X arbitrage, although I don't know, I feel like it's kind of just part of the game. And at the end of the day, we would, you know, we want to get to a world where price discovery is happening on chain. It's not just like market makers relaying prices from Binance onto Solana. And then of course, if we did it that way, then you're also going to lose a decent chunk of the non-toxic atomic arb flow.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So where do you see the next step in this then? How do you get to the next level, like V2 after Phoenix? What's launched kind of first product done after POC?
Yeah, so some of the stuff we've already touched on briefly here, one of them is programmable liquidity. So allowing retail users to participate on the liquidity providing side, should they decide to. You can also have competition between different people who are designing different liquidity curves for different pools, which I think is a really interesting design space, especially in a compute constrained environment. There's also this problem of like who pays for the gas. Like you can get gas griefed as a taker if someone has like a really complicated maker algorithm that you're paying gas for. There's some stuff we can do to give market makers a little bit more of an advantage. I don't think you're going to be able to like perfectly discriminate just in time against all toxic flow, but maybe you can get a little bit of the way there by giving market makers this ability to essentially have a just-in-time action when their orders get filled. So at a very high level, the way this would look is my maker order gets filled. My maker order also contains this piece of code that gets run after my order gets filled. And maybe that is like canceling some other orders. Maybe it's replacing liquidity on the other side. Just giving market makers a little bit more of an action space to do stuff that otherwise they would do in a much slower way. So like if my market making behavior is, if I get filled on my top of book order, I want to replace it on the other side of the book. The current way you would do it is you wait to hear that you got filled. Then you send another transaction to the network. You wait for that transaction to land. And only when it lands are you now on the other side of the book. And here, this would just happen like atomically.
Well, liquidity is quite interesting. Have you heard of Arrakis Finance before?
I've heard of them, not super aware of what they do.
I had a chat with a fella from Arrakis Finance on a previous podcast, and we talked about the inefficiencies of V2 liquidity, even V3. Like, you're still not making a crazy amount because JIT strategies on Ethereum. So really just LP liquidity providers are exit liquidity, essentially. So how do you see them not becoming exit liquidity anymore and actually making money?
Yeah, a couple points here. One is JIT liquidity, I think, I haven't looked at the numbers in a while, but when I looked, it seems to be like very, very overstated relative to how much is actually happening and how profitable it actually is. It's like a very, very capital intensive strategy, and there's not like, there's just like not that many good trades. So you are locking up a lot of capital for a relatively small opportunity. And it's like, it's not super risky. It's like a little bit risky. So there's not a ton of JIT that is really meaningfully affecting LP returns, at least as I understand it.
But I don't think there's any risk though, if it's all atomic. Like if you're doing, let's say a sandwich, for example, Jared, he's doing a Big Mac sandwich, and then encompassing all that is just, you know, JIT for the liquidity pools, and he exits right after the atomic, you know, sandwich.
So sandwiches are atomic if you trust the bundle abstraction, but there's also the more standard form of JIT is basically you come in to fill someone's market order and then you're taking some inventory risk, right? It's like similar to a DEX-X arbitrage. But yeah, I agree, there's like multiple forms of JIT liquidity. Programmable liquidity, I think it can come in a bunch of different forms. I think first of all, again, there's no guarantee ever that LPs are going to make money because fundamentally what it comes down to is there's a supply of liquidity and demand for liquidity, right? And if there's only so much demand and then now you have like infinite retail supply of liquidity, yeah, it's probably just not all going to be that profitable.
Right.
Because if you fix the amount of non-toxic flow and then you increase the amount of liquidity, the total profits from the non-toxic flow do not go up, but the amount of toxic flow increases linearly. And so there's like some liquidity threshold. And when you go past that, like, yeah, the total liquidity pool just has to become not profitable. But hopefully we can do things that are more efficient than pure XY equals K. One very obvious thing you can do is bring in an Oracle price. This is what Lifinity has been doing since, I believe, 2021. They're an AMM on Solana. Really appreciate what they do because it was a thing that was built on Solana that was just like not possible to build on Ethereum because of the Oracle latency. And with Solana's Oracles updating, you know, they're trying to update once a slot. They probably update not quite that frequently, but just having any price indication whatsoever can help decrease the amount of toxic flow that hits you. So their LP returns are significantly better. They're also capped deposits because, like any liquidity providing strategy is capacity constrained. There's another way you can get retail LPs higher returns, which is through direct lending to market makers, where if I'm Citadel, maybe when I'm investing dollars, I require like a 50% hurdle rate for it to be worth my time. And maybe I have the Phoenix strategy that can make 30%. So I'm not going to deploy my own capital in there. But if retail is happy to get 20%, then there's a trade to be made there where retail lends the capital at 20%.
Oh yeah.
Citadel makes 30% and then clips the margin in the middle. So there's a lot of interesting things that can be done here. That's clearly not directly like retail providing liquidity. It's similar to the HLP model on Hyperliquid, where essentially you're lending capital for someone else to operate a strategy on.
I remember, I think this was a part of the last conversation I had in this liquidity stuff, but having retail just deposit into a vault, like a, let's say it's just like V2, where you just throw in some tokens, but then having that vault adjust like a Uniswap V3, like tick range, continuously adjusting as the liquidity changes. I think that might be quite interesting. So everyone is really just in the range. And if there's everyone in that range, does it really move? And how much does it take to move the price?
I think a lot of these models don't tend to actually work because the question that never gets answered is what happens when the liquidity moves out of range? Like what is the rebalancing process? And almost always the rebalancing process is like, okay, we started out at 50-50, maybe quoting in this range, just like 10% below to 10% above. And then now the price has moved down 10%. And so I'm fully allocated to asset B, 0% asset A, providing no liquidity on one side. How do I get back to 50-50? And usually it's like, I'm going to market sell half of token B to get back to token A. And that trade turns out to be extremely, extremely unprofitable.
Right. Oh, okay. Interesting. I wonder what else there would be. Maybe like multiple ranges, like big chunks of liquidity. So instead of one big chunk in one range, you have maybe two standard deviations both sides, and they're continuously moving around. I don't know. I'm just trying to think of stuff.
Yeah. The problem is the moving around. Like when you need to adjust the liquidity, what is the mechanism for that? And usually that involves drawing from an alternate liquidity source, which is probably going to be a market maker on Binance.
Okay. I see what you're saying. Interesting. Well, hopefully people start making these programmable liquidity provision.
Yeah, it's really challenging to design the right interface, right? Like I think in crypto, we had this like reliance on the permissionless innovation layer, right? Where we build these blockchains, other people have built these blockchains, and there are these not quite Turing complete, but kind of Turing complete environments with tokens on them. And then the sell to the application developer is build whatever the hell you want on this. And I think a lot of the results have not been very impressive. And I think if you really constrain the design space, you can get more interesting things to come out of it, where the platform developer so in our example, you know, we're like the DEX designers, what levers do we want to give the market makers to pool? Maybe we don't want them to be able to attach like any piece of code to their order. but there's like a couple of, there's like five actions you could do on your like post-hook, post-trade hook or pre-trade hook or whatever you want to call it. And designing, like figuring out the design space, figuring out the action space is really, really important here. And you don't actually want it to be maximally unconstrained.
Yeah, I think doing it for retail as well would be an even more difficult problem. Because you can make a UI for this, but it seems like more of a programmer's kind of deal. And then programmers are really like, I don't know, we'll say 10% of who's in it. And so like the other 90% retail is just going to... Yeah, that seems like a very difficult problem.
I think you want competition between the pros to design like, yeah, the best liquidity curves or the best liquidity vaults. And then you want a way to enforce that the marketing towards retail is as honest and representative as possible. I think that's obviously a huge problem in our industry. And then let retail make decisions from there. But yeah, I don't think retail is going to be programming their own Phoenix bots. I don't think they ought to be spending a ton of time programming their own liquidity curves, although there at least I think the you can't do that bad. You can't do that much worse than XY equals K.
What about, have you heard of these things where it's like a manager, like kind of SocialFi, where you have a manager and people deposit money into it and then the manager just kind of like messes around? It kind of, I guess, like a hedge fund. But then if you have multiple of these managers, maybe they like adjust the liquidity for the users. You know, although it could be like super bad, but I guess they're incentivized to do it well because of the fees and they also have reputation. I don't think anyone's really done that where you have managers controlling portions of liquidity a retail deposit into them. So it's like a vault.
So there is some stuff like this. There are some attack vectors. So I think like Hyperliquid has something like this where, anyone can create a vault. So basically anyone can effectively solicit retail deposits for the manager to trade on their behalf. And then the problem is the manager now can, with their personal account, do something like buy a shitcoin, then have the fund buy the shitcoin, then have the TA dump the shitcoin. So like the incentive alignment here, I think, is quite tough. And this also exists in traditional finance, right? And it's why if you're like an RIA, you have like a lot of regulations you need to comply with, such as, hey, I'm not going to trade in my personal account against the fund.
Right. Yeah, that's the biggest vector.
Enforcing this type of thing on chain seems rather difficult.
Yeah.
This is why I like the lending model a little bit better. And you have to figure out how these things are going to get collateralized, and you have to make sure like the action space for the market maker who is borrowing the money is somewhat constrained, so they can't like, again, make some really, really unprofitable trades on behalf of the users and get that account liquidated while making the profit on their own like personal account on the side.
The lending, actually, I kind of like the lending thing. If retail are depositing into a pool of lending, but it's also
Yeah, you just need to be able to put the capital that's getting borrowed to work, right? So you need this lending protocol to be very aware of what is happening inside the exchange as well.
Yeah, the key is the working capital instead of just passively being exit.
And the more complicated these protocols get, the larger the surface of potential exploits, whether they're code exploits or economic exploits. And I think that space grows like super linearly in the number of like features that you add.
Have you thought about doing like maybe multi-chain, and then you can kind of combine them to do cross-chain stuff for people?
I've thought very, very little about cross-chain anything.
Okay. Yeah, because I just imagine if you have an order book on every chain, and then that would enable like, I guess, cross-chain arbitrage, statistical arbitrage, maybe cross-chain as well.
But if you're the liquidity provider, wouldn't you prefer to just be quoting on one environment rather than n environments?
Yeah, this is true. But I'm just thinking of more things that can be enabled, though. When you see it and it happening, maybe you'll get a new idea for something else down the road. I don't know, maybe it could be something interesting. Okay. Is there anyone that you see doing anything like Phoenix? Because there was Serum, but like, you know, anyone else that's recent?
We're not seeing anything on Solana specifically. I think there's a fair amount of teams that are building order books or order book like things in other ecosystems. So as you mentioned, there's a lot of these off-chain order books now settle to, or have some semblance of settlements to a layer 2 or to a layer 1. Then there's also a bunch of teams working on limit order books on Monad. And so if Monad can deliver on the performance they claim they're going to deliver, I think order books will be quite viable there. Some of the stuff that we build, those protocols would probably, in theory, be viable there as well.
Okay.
So when we started in 2022 and we're like, hey, we want active liquidity on chain, there was literally nowhere else to go. And I would say even today, there's nowhere to go besides Solana. Maybe Aptos and Sui, haven't looked too deeply over there, but the total opportunity size there seems smaller as well. But if Monad can deliver on performance and cost, then a lot of stuff that was previously only viable on Solana may become viable there too.
Gotcha. Man, I hope this does happen. Because can you make like a shitcoin market? So instead of having just like the big coins, like I guess Jito, Solana, stable coins as well. When a new shitcoin comes up, can they just create a market instantly, just like Uniswap? And then people can start, putting in limit orders and stuff like that.
You mean on Phoenix today?
Yeah.
Yeah, so market creation is permissionless. So anyone can make a market with whatever coins they want and place whatever orders they want. They won't show up on our UI, but they will get picked up by like the aggregators and whatnot. Cool. Honestly, I think like limit order is the right abstraction for some types of shitcoin trading. As we both know, a lot of shitcoin trading involves, especially early on, big market orders, ripping through a bunch of liquidity, getting sandwiched, high slippage tolerance because you're very, very time sensitive, etc.
I wonder if you partner up with like pump.fun and then you instantly create a market when a token's created. I think that would be quite interesting.
I think the primary issue here is needing some way to support the passive liquidity, because there has to be passive liquidity for the shitcoin. You're not going to have a market maker who's going to be willing to immediately spin up a market maker for each new pump.fun coin that graduates. So you'll need some combination of passive liquidity and active liquidity. When I think of passive liquidity, usually I treat it as like liquidity of last resort. I think the ambient finance model makes quite a bit of sense here. Actually makes way more sense for shitcoins than XY equals K, where you have like passive liquidity is still the first class citizen for ambient finance, but they also support limit orders. And so if you have limit orders on the book, essentially, or basically any orders that are not two-sided, you really, really decrease the viability of sandwich attacks. And sandwiching is costing users on Solana, I don't know what the numbers are today, either like high six figures or low seven figures per day. It's like an absurd amount of money. And that's money that is just like flowing out of the ecosystem. And it would be better if it wasn't, if it wasn't getting drained out like that.
I actually did one with the ambient guys as well a bit recently. I like their hybrid model.
Yep, I think it makes a lot of sense.
Interesting. Well, I'm super keen to see how Phoenix progresses. Probably going to be a cornerstone in Solana going forth. Super excited to see if you create, the pro liquidity. Bring back the food coin days of MasterChef and all the tokenization of liquidity. Please.
Oh yeah, I hope we can do a little bit better than that. I don't think everything necessarily needs to be tokenized. Hopefully we have coins that are a little bit better than the food coins. But yeah, we're like always very interested in how can we innovate on the core on-chain liquidity primitive, because I feel like that's kind of the promise of DeFi, right? Like we want to build not just a system that exists on-chain, but a system that exists on-chain that is better than what exists in traditional finance, that would exist on centralized exchanges. And we have to move off of, like, if you look at Phoenix today, what is it really? It's like a shitty version of Coinbase that happens to be on chain. We would like it to be a superior product to Coinbase that also lives on chain.
Hell yeah. Well, I'm super excited to see that. And I think Solana's the perfect spot right now, especially with all the heat gathering up with Andrew Tate's shitcoin and then Iggy Azalea, I think her name is. Just it's bringing a lot of attention. So you're definitely in a right position.
There is a lot of attention on Solana today. There is a lot of opportunity on Solana. A lot of problems with Solana too, but there are competent people working on them.
Yeah, 100%. They're very smart. I have a few podcasts with with those kind of leaders as well. So you've joined the ranks, my friend.
That's cool.
But Eugene, man, thank you so much for taking the time, explaining Phoenix, the wonderful innovations that are happening on Solana. So guys, go on Solana, use Phoenix. But man, really appreciate your time once again.
Thanks for having me on.
Of course. And I'm sure we'll talk again soon down the line when you become the Coinbase of on-chain order books.
That's right.
All right, man. Thank you so much. And everyone take care.